Namaste, good morning to you all. Today, I would like to touch upon two topics briefly, after which we will open the floor up for questions or sharing. The first is Mahashivratri, since it is coming up in a few days. Mahashivratri, which literally translates as the grand night of Shiva. Mahashivratri is very dear to Hinduism, and based on an ancient science where the rishis, the seers, decoded this one night amongst all the nights of the year, when the Shiva principle, the Shiva Tattva, comes closest to earth, and how to take advantage of this phenomenon. The unicity, the totality, Shiva became Shiva Shakti in duality in the manifest world as we know it. And this one night in the year, which facilitates the reconnection, so to speak, to the source, which helps people on their spiritual journeys, acts as an accelerator, so to speak. And that is why this practice of staying up all night. Staying up means keeping the spine straight, vertical, the gift given to the human species, the vertical spine. And so, this yogic practice, which in many ashrams across the length and breadth of the country will be followed, keeping the sadhaks, the seekers awake all night through chanting, singing, japa, and so on and so forth, in the quest for reconnecting to the source, which is what wisdom teachings are about, which is what I speak about is about. Now, when it comes to this precious teaching of Advaita, where those familiar with it know the core concepts are thy will be done, nobody is the doer of their actions, and so on. When these concepts are accepted, imbibed, and lived, then what is happening is the default setting of the ego based on separation from the source, acting as if it has personal power, is a power center operating in life, in charge of my life, and so on and so forth. When this ego center is reintroduced to the concepts of divine will, consciousness is all there is. We are all instruments through whom the same consciousness functions, and so on and so forth, resulting in a conflicted mind turning towards peace. By and by, when the ego identified with the thinking mind, which earlier used to hate, blame, condemn, judge, and so on and so forth, is now introduced to this way of looking at things and its direct impact being peace of mind in daily living. The process of recalibration has begun towards the source. So it appears that the wisdom teachings infuse fresh conditioning into this ego, which was earlier operating on the conditioning of I am the doer, and so are others. But what is actually happening is space is being created to allow the qualities of the self, the one self, to shine through. What Joel Goldsmith referred to as the unconditioned mind. Now, we can argue that we can't help but operate through our conditioning. But when this play is seen for what it is quite true that we are being deconditioned from our previous conditioning. And when we are in a state of witness consciousness, because we are not mired like we used to be in me and my story and my drama of life, Sakshi Bhav, taking a step back, seeing events flow without getting entangled in them and tripping over ourselves, then one could say it is this unconditioned mind which is operating. The conscious presence, the pure being, operating as a separate entity in a dualistic world, but not lost in the dream of dualism. My spiritual guide made this distinction between duality and dualism. Nobody can escape duality. That is the structure of life and living. But when the me and the other becomes me versus the other, then we are lost in the living dream of life. And it is this me versus the other which leads to psychological suffering. Now, me versus the other also means me versus myself. This point is missed. If everything and everyone is an aspect of the one self, and if I find I'm battling people all the time, I'm battling myself. So what teachings like this do is they remove the focus from personhood, from individuality. Earlier, the ego is focused on individuals with certain characteristics, personality traits, and becomes obsessed by them, thinking everyone is an autonomous, independent entity responsible for who they are. When the hand of God, the source consciousness, is seen behind and above everyone, that is the Shiva Tattva. That is the Shiva principle, which one is reintroduced to. And that is why Goldsmith would say that we have to constantly reinterpret what we see. Reinterpret. Because we are too quick to judge. And by and by, when we start seeing this unicity behind it all, that everyone is operating according to their blueprint, their destiny, their nature, including myself, what starts happening is an acceptance of others the way God has made them, and more importantly, an acceptance of myself, what is referred to as self-love, the way God has made me. I may not like certain qualities of mine, certain attributes, but when I realize I didn't create them myself. Circumstances of life, my geographical environment, the nature of my parents, the religion I was born into, and so on and so forth, shaped me. When I start realizing this and accepting myself more and more, I start accepting others more and more. As within, so without. The famous saying, "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." This truth, which my teacher would say, can only be one. Everything else is a concept. The only truth is that which nobody can deny. Nobody. And that truth which nobody can deny is their existence. I am. And so this teaching is making one rest more and more in this I am, resting in being. And this is where the Guru principle comes in. The Guru principle reintroduces the individual to where it came from. The Guru is not a person in that sense. It is consciousness reintroducing the individual to consciousness. The individual operating in the split mind, always shuttling and being shunted between the polarities of life. And so that which brings the individual into equilibrium, balance, equanimity, and peace is the Guru. So the Guru is one's own higher self. And one starts operating from this dimension more and more in life. When challenges are faced, situations come, that is what happens. That is why they say, you may leave the Guru, but the Guru can never leave you. Because the Guru is not apart from you. But you, the individual, with your set way of thinking and behaving, may think, oh, I can move away from the Guru. Because we are stuck in the world of form. We feel that what we see is all there is. That is the grand deception. Already our seeing is so limited that out of five sheets, the physical eyes can see only the food body. And based on what we see, we judge.
All right.
If anyone would like to share anything or ask anything, they are most welcome to now. Yes, Meera.
Namaste, Gautam.
Namaste.
Gautam, this topic is very apt because I am dealing with anger management issues, especially as I've come back to my original home, the same conditioning, the same environment. And I was dealing with a lot of self-judgment, saying that I'm not able to be the beacon of peace that I want to be, or how far from my spiritual journey may I have, or maybe I have not progressed at all in my spiritual journey. So there was a lot of self-judgment, fear of not having done enough, being enough. So your teachings have helped because I realize I'm not the doer or the creator of my nature. So thank you so much. However, the ego still comes in through the side door and the back door and says, all this work you've done on your spiritual path, it's a waste. You're neither of good to yourself nor to your family. You're instead burning people on your path. So that ego is very strong. I would love your insights, tips. Thank you.
So, you know, Meera, there are people who are not even aware of this much. Let's say, for example, there are people who are very angry, have anger issues, and are unaware of it. They, in fact, are the ones who are suffering unconsciously. In what you have described, you are suffering consciously because there's awareness. I'm aware of my personality, certain qualities, certain things which are triggering me. That first step itself is a big gift. One has to be grateful to God for that, because now it has set in an intention which I am trying to follow with earnestness. Yes, perhaps I find myself failing repeatedly. Yet, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, all I can do is try. That's all we can do. And so what happens? There's no harm in aspiring. There's no harm in wishing I was not this way, not doing these things, because I can see the damage it's doing to others and myself. But my constant prayer becomes, not my will, O Lord, but thine be done. And yet, I keep trying. I keep doing that which I think and feel I should do. That is all. So this teaching will not say, do this and don't do that. It is not a prescription. All it is saying is, watch, observe, see this play of life, self-investigate, ask yourself, look at the situations which disturb your peace. That is all. But my teacher would say, no spiritual seeker should consider their glass half empty, but half full. Because if God has brought you so far to even this level of awareness, why do you feel He will drop you here? So to keep that faith that this is the journey of life, this is the journey of getting to know myself. There are going to be challenges. Everyone has their demons to deal with. This is mine. And step by step, by and by, all I can do is try. But it takes humility to even acknowledge my failings. Some egos are not willing to do that also, you see. So I would say not to lose hope, not to lose faith. Everything is exactly the way it is meant to be. Everything is appropriate on this journey of self-discovery. Space must be given and allowed for it to unravel itself. And you must know that a higher power is shining a light on your path. Light shineth in the darkness, but the darkness comprehendeth not. And the other thing I'd like to add is, what we focus on tends to grow. So why be focused only on this so-called negative quality? Shift the mind to something else. All right? Are you there?
Yes, Gautam, I'm here. That was really helpful. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Take care. Yes, Rani.
नमस्ते गौतम जी.
नमस्ते.
टू कीप इट शॉर्ट, आई आई एम यूजिंग माय निकनेम हियर. माय नेम इज हर्षद एक्चुअली.
यस अक्षदा.
सो क्वेश्चन इज एक्सेप्टिंग माय सेल्फ एंड एक्सेप्टिंग अदर्स, व्हाट डज एक्सेप्टेंस मीन एग्जैक्टली हियर?
If I find myself complaining about people all the time and the way they are, that means I am not accepting the way God has made them. If the content of my own consciousness is one of judging and complaining, means I have not realized that they have been shaped by the one divine, just like I have. So I'm rejecting people. I'm passing judgment on them. I'm telling them how they should be, what they ought to be doing. My language is full of shoulds, woulds, and coulds. I'm in conflict with people because of that. That means I have not accepted them. It means I have not accepted myself. Does that make sense? What is the opposite? The polaric opposite of acceptance is rejection. If you take someone in your own life who has troubled you, and you see that maybe earlier you were holding this person fully accountable, the whole and soul of it all, that they had full control over them, their selves since they were born. But now you are listening to someone and a teaching which says that, hold on, relook at this assumption of yours. For example, you don't know how this person's parents treated them when they were young, what conditioning they imbibed, on the basis of which they say and do things which might be hurting you. Then you say, oh my God, I didn't think of it that way. Then I start accepting this person being the way they are more and more. It does not mean I have to like it. I yet may have to do certain things to safeguard myself, protect myself if I feel the need to. Life goes on. But because I have accepted the fact that this person is created by circumstances and situations beyond their control, I am no longer rejecting them. I no longer have hatred, condemnation, and ill will towards them. That is what it means. This is what is referred to as the healing consciousness. In my own mind, the person has been healed within my own consciousness, which was a consciousness of segregating, compartmentalizing, separating people. That is what has been happening, and now it is replaced by the consciousness of acceptance.
Awesome.
Right? It is awesome. It really is. Anything else, Harshada?
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Suresh.
Hari Om, Gautam ji.
Hari Om.
First of all, wonderful retreat at Thiruvannamalai. I'm still in bliss from that retreat. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it too.
Yes. My question today is, you mentioned during the talk today about consciousness getting reintroduced to consciousness. And also in one of your earlier talks, you had mentioned where, consciousness being offered to consciousness is actually a gift. And can you elaborate a little bit more? So, like our individual consciousness is identifying with the Supreme. And when it is identifying and it is in the process of integrating, how that becomes powerful and how that becomes a gift.
I think you have, in fact, expressed it very beautifully yourself, and it doesn't really need more words. How it becomes a gift is by the peace it bestows on us. This consciousness of one, this consciousness of not two, is the healing consciousness of peace, the peace that passeth understanding. So, what is happening is, while it appears that this teaching is using words, explaining, nobody is the doer of their actions, look at the hand of God behind it all, this is what one already knows deep within, but we have forgotten it. And so when we are reintroduced to it, we are no longer following the trajectory of separation and personhood, because as Goldsmith says, when our relationship is no longer with individuals, what he means is no longer with individual personalities as being separate power centers apart from God. When our relationship is no longer with individuals, it means our relationship is with God. Doesn't this mean, in other words, that our relationship is now with the one self and not the many? So you see, that way it is a mischievous teaching. It holds the ego's hand as a separate person, taking it through understanding this concept. But what it is actually doing is eliminating this ego's sense of separation while it's holding its hand. And suddenly you look back and say, my God, I was annihilated without my knowing. Because no ego would want to kill itself, you see. That's why my teacher was quite against using this term, kill the ego, kill the ego. Why would the ego want to kill itself? And so his approach was to talk to the ego, explain to the ego, show the ego where it has been confused. Let the light shine with the cooperation of the ego. That was his approach. That is why he would say, my guru, Nisargadatta Maharaj, would say, I am that. Whereas I say, that is you, me, he, and she. So in that sense, you could say the goal is the same, but the approach is different. And so by and by, one finds in daily living, one rests more and more in the whole mind, not in the split mind. That is what happens. Because what is actually happening is the eyes of duality are no longer mesmerized by the show.
Yes.
The eye of singularity is in operation, the third eye of Shiva. That is what is happening. The eye of wisdom, the eye of Gyan, the Agnya Chakra. The eye which cannot be seen with the physical eyes is the eye that is operating. That is what happens. Right? Sorry, I think we got hacked there. Shiva Tandava. What to do? So if it happens again, I'll just exit the meeting again and try coming back in. Apologies for that. Suresh, so does that help the discussion we had?
Absolutely, totally. And as you rightly said, let's not focus on what not, need not be focused, which is the hack. And I would say one other thing is it makes complete sense. You know, the gift is really the peace that you talked about.
Yes.
And that is what I felt, from our retreat, coming back into the busy life, that peace is still there in the background. So I'm very thankful for that. And just a quick note, and just wanted your views on it. So in terms of any reactions, it's very moderated for me. So sometimes I feel that maybe I'm not reacting what I should be actually acting in the outside world. So inside, I'm like fine, but I'm like, okay, should I be doing a little bit more, because the other person shouldn't be offended because they are doing something nice, or if they wanted to be really mean, I'm like not impacted. So to that extent, I feel a little bit disconnected from the so-called reality versus my current reality.
Yes.
Any guidance on, because yeah. there are not many who are following the path. So, and I'm like, am I going the right way about it?
Yes.
And what should I be anchored on? Thank you.
Yes. And this is actually what many of us face when we discover this sense of peace and tranquility and calm, that we are probably no longer behaving a certain way like we used to, and that may be considered not normal. The answer is very simple. As long as there is a sensitivity to others, being mindful of how they might feel, we take those steps because you see, we don't want to make someone feel unacknowledged, unappreciated, unloved. We have rediscovered something within us. It is our journey, our story. And so, as long as we are not stepping on people's toes, not offending them in any way, we are mindful of how the other is. And honestly, this does not require any work. It becomes a default setting. That is why the Buddha said, compassion arises. Compassion arises. And that compassion to see the human drama for what it is, how egos are designed to suck you into drama, how your own ego is designed to suck you yourself into your drama. All this is seen, you see. So it is a process of perhaps teaching oneself a new way of dealing with people, situations, so that I am not becoming too dramatic or drastic because of the shift that has happened within my own being. So this also is part of the journey, but rest assured that this is something which will happen on its own. It doesn't need much of your help. It happens. And one thing I must add is retreats. My suggestion is when one goes to any retreat, any spiritual retreat, allow yourself some time to reintegrate. Don't rush back into work. Don't just get back into your busy life, which is what I used to do. I remember when I would attend Eckhart Tolle's retreats when I was young, I would come back and I was back to my routine, back to life, back to everything the next morning. But if one allows what has been received in the retreat to permeate, to settle in, and then by and by one starts reintegrating into life, that will stay on longer. Otherwise, the mind gets too busy and too involved with its past where it comes from and is rushing back into that. So in that sense, it does feel like I have lost the essence of the retreat, what I touched upon in the retreat. Actually, that can never be lost. That can never be lost, but because the mind is so strong and the mind kicks back in, it appears that it is lost. And let's not forget one thing. This is especially true for those who are living in big cities, not someone who's out in nature somewhere. You are surrounded by hundreds of thousands of thinking minds. It's all a vibration.
Yes.
And so one has to even be cognizant of this fact that there's a vibratory field around where I am when I might perhaps plug into it, you see. So all these things one becomes very sensitive to when one attends a retreat. And one has to be mindful of this. Ultimately, one rises above it all. But while the process is going on, while the journey is going on, this journey of the rediscovery of peace, it helps to be mindful of all this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, is it Janani? Have I pronounced it correctly?
Yes, pranams Gautamji. This is Janani.
Janani.
Thank you so much, firstly, for your podcast with Nikhilji. I've heard that for a few years now, and that's one of the reasons I found your website and I'm here. I have a question. I would like to know more about making decisions intuitively rather than logically. Any insights on making the most peaceful decisions?
Yes. Very nice question. Because I have always made decisions logically. Now, I'll tell you, actually, if we go beyond these words of making a decision intuitively versus logically, according to this teaching, decisions still have to be made. That does not change. My decision is based on my up-to-date conditioning and my nature. So I weigh the pros and cons. I have to decide whether it may be a very small decision about when to fix a doctor's appointment, when to visit a shop, whatever it may be, or a big decision. I have to decide. I have to use my intellect, my buddhi, to guide me a certain way. But when I realize that my decision is truly not mine. It is a decision which has to be made, then the burden of the decision is lifted from my shoulders. When this happens, when I know that decision making is the part of the process of life, I cannot control the outcome of the decision, as it is said in the Gita. All I can do is take a decision. The results are not in my control. When this happens, I find that my decisions are more intuitive. Why? Because the burden of the thinking mind is not bogging me down. This thinking mind, which is trying to ensure an outcome, force an outcome. And so I'm getting stuck in the decision-making process all the time, wondering, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the right thing? Then the logical mind is overburdened. It can burn up. It's on fire. But when one rests in knowing, decisions will be made. Outcomes may or may not be according to the way I want them. Then by default, I will not overextend the logical mind in the duration of time, because that is based on fear. Fear that I will make the wrong decision. When that fear goes, concern, yes, that is why I'm thinking about a decision to be made. But when the fear of making the wrong decision goes, by and by, I find that the intuitive brain is working. So they are actually the same. It is not an either or and someone saying, don't do it this way, do it this way. That is why my teacher would say, understanding is all. Maharaj would say, understanding is all. And so rest of my life, there will be decisions to be taken. I will take decisions, but I am freed of being the whole and sole accountable and responsible for the decision. Yet, consequences I must face. All actions have consequences. We are in the cause-effect realm of duality. That is bound to happen. But I am now more and more at peace while taking the decision, you see. That is what happens. Does that help?
Yes, I was just able to unmute myself. Yes, that definitely helps. You had also given one example of even Hanuman taking a decision of closing the cave, but when the Rishi, the Asura came in the Rishi's disguise, he was not able to discriminate. If such a high being couldn't, how are we to always keep the Viveka?
Precisely. So let's release ourselves from the burden of taking the right decision. Let's act as if we can take the right decision, knowing that we cannot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes, Ganesh.
Hey, Pranam Guruji.
Pranam.
So, I have two questions for you. The first one, I need blessings. I got married recently, very recently, 2 weeks back. And I am going to be a householder, Sadak. So, quick hacks. I know the teaching is all about relationship and peace of mind. So quick hacks for a person who have got married recently, who may get into its work and all these things in the beginning of the marriage life. That's one thing. Second thing, how to get initiated to Navnath Sampradaya? Because this ego, Ganesh ego, wants to associate it with some kind of lineage so that it will, it has a bit of security, feel a bit of security and association. So these are the two questions for us.
Well, congratulations on your marriage, Ganesh. And I don't know of any quick hacks. If you learn some, please tell me about them. But you see, there's something beautiful, not just about marriage, but just having a partner or a companion in life. It allows one to no longer focus on oneself, but focus on the other. You see, that itself, I feel, is a form of healing, because we are so self-obsessed normally that an opportunity is provided to find the self in the other. That is what happens. So all I would suggest is just allow the other to be who they are, an equal expression of the divine, without wanting them to be any other way. To me, that is true love. And so to see the beauty of God's creation, to be given the opportunity to the best of one's ability, help the other in any way possible, be present for the other, I think that is the gift of companionship. The spotlight is moved away from me. Now, my spiritual teacher had a very simple formula. When he was asked about his relationship with his wife, he said, it's very simple. She goes her way and I go her way. So that is, and Ganesh, after all, it's, you are Ganesh, all compassionate. Ganpati, I don't think, is going to have a very hard time navigating this journey of marriage. I'm sure you have the blessings of Ganesha, the masters. Everyone does. Everyone does. And I really wish you a journey of discovering aspects of life, qualities of life and living together. That is, it's such a beauty when it is a shared experience. It is very beautiful. Now, regarding your second question, if you have this need to link to a lineage, a parampara, and it is the Navnath Sampradaya, you have to choose and find someone who will initiate you. Now, the yogic path is of different kinds, like certain Navnath Sampradaya paths are very sadhana-based and practice-based. So if that appeals to you, then you have to follow that path. That involves japa, that involves a lot of reading of the scriptures and so on and so forth. So that is something you have to decide, that if I have this feeling, this yearning to be part of a lineage, and if it is the Navnath Sampradaya, you have to explore and find within the Navnath Sampradaya which appeals to you the most. So for example, you could meet a yogi from the Gorakhnath tradition, and he can guide you, or someone from any other tradition, and they can guide you, and you can be formally initiated by them. But make it clear that yours is a householder life, householder way of living, and so make sure that this initiation does not come into conflict with your life situation, because then it will be very hard. Does that help?
Thank you, Guruji, for your kind blessings and congratulations. See,
Ganesh, the lineage I belong to is a householder lineage. People in the world, people facing the challenges of life, they were not ascetics in a cave. It was not the path of celibacy and so on and so forth. And even my Sufi mentors, the Sufi lineage I am linked to is again a householder lineage. They have families, they have children, they have grandchildren. So in these cases, it was not a formal initiation which I underwent and had to go through, but it is something that is what appeals to you. Then by all means, pursue it, but be mindful of the fact that you have just got married too. All right?
Thank you, Guruji. Just because I got married, I want to get initiated to the householder lineage.
Yes, yes. That's good. Yes, Sarthak.
Namaste, Gautamji. How have you been?
Good, good. Thank you. How are you doing?
Excellent. Never been better. There's this song I used to find really catchy back in the day. It's called Money is the Root of All Evil. Money is the Root of All Sin. It's by the Andrew Sisters. It's an old wartime song. You might like it. So my question for today was, I know you've gone into this in your videos too, like your attitude with money and how it just flows from, one part of consciousness into one pocket to another, in essence. But I still wanted to get your views on the attitude and approach while being present when it comes to dealing with people with money and yourself. How do you deal with money in a, day-to-day basis? How do you become more sort of detached yet creative with money?
So I don't subscribe to this view that money is evil because there's no power apart from God.
Right.
Consciousness is all there is. I think what it means, what it is pointing to, is money becomes evil when money itself is the end and not the means to an end. When one is so focused on money. And why is one focused on money? Because the ego is afraid. It is afraid to die. And money ensures my survival. I know I'm pushing it to the extreme, but this is at the root of it, you see. And so when money is seen as an energy, a part of life, a force of life, Lakshmi, it is honored for what it is. But one is no longer obsessed about it. One sees that earning money is based on factors beyond my control. So it truly is not my money. And after all, let's not forget the money came from somewhere else whom it belonged to earlier. So that is how my relationship with money becomes much lighter because I don't derive my sense of self from money like I used to. I am no longer identified with it like I was earlier. So that is why my teacher would say one quality when you know the teaching has been going deep inside is generosity arises naturally. One is giving more and more and more rather than receiving. You see, the me loves to receive. The me center is so strong, so powerful, it wants to receive money also. And one who is not bound by this is more free in dissipating the money, just dissipating the energy, allowing it to flow, let it go where it has to, is not so deeply rooted in survival that it's going to become a hoarder and spend just like 2% of what I actually have because I must save for a rainy day and so on and so forth. These are all what set in with a lack, conditioning of lack in childhood, in the formative years. So the me wants to ensure its survival. So I feel one just has to understand one's attachment to money and one becomes free of it. Yet one is pragmatic because you, especially if one is in a householder situation, you have to project future expenses, be mindful of that. But you're not really going to be in a situation where, you are withholding from the universe, what can easily be given. So I think it's a great sadhana. My relationship with money is a great sadhana to explore, to understand. It's quite beautiful, actually.
Yes, that's what I've been exploring actually, because like I used to get very tripped up by it, and I don't I also don't subscribe to the thing that money is the root of all evil. I mean, the root of all good and evil in the world is the mind
Yes.
after all.
Yeah.
So yeah, let me contemplate on that. But yes, I feel like the money sadhana is something that people often overlook, especially on the spiritual path.
You know, now in, as I said earlier, when you do the Girivalam of Arunachala, 25 years ago, they would either say Arunachala Shiva or Om Namah Shiva if you passed a sadhu on the Girivalam. Now it becomes either Arunachala Shiva money or Om Namah Shivaya money. They ask for money all the time. Okay. Okay, Sarthak. Thank you for that question. Yes, F.
Good morning, Gautam.
Good morning. Are you in Thailand now?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Just a quick question, going back to a question which we made before. Doesn't accepting yourself also mean accepting ourselves when we cannot accept?
Sorry, can you say that again?
Doesn't accepting ourselves also mean accepting ourselves when we cannot accept ourselves?
Yes, most beautifully said. Accepting that even where I'm finding it hard to accept a certain quality of myself had to happen. I cannot accept I am this way. One has to accept even that. Absolutely right. The sheer helplessness of it all is seen.
That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, Vikram.
Good morning, Gautam. Great to
Morning.
see you again and all the Guru Bandhus here from the Thirumanala retreat. Just a very short question. You've used this today, the phrase, as within, so without, and previous lectures, podcasts too. I don't probably get it fully, so it'd be good to get a view of what that means.
So, sorry, what is the question?
You've used the phrase as within, so without.
Yes.
I don't fully understand it.
There's only one consciousness. What I project onto others, onto individuals, is part of my own consciousness. You see, in alchemy, this principle of as within, so without is very important, because the alchemist is concerned with converting base metal into gold. That is the science of alchemy. Now, the caveat is, this can only happen, the alchemist can only reach the stage of producing gold if the alchemist himself reaches the state of self-realization. So someone who has not reached that state is not given the gift of being able to produce the gold, because then it can be misused, because the alchemical gold produces more gold itself. You don't have to go through the entire process itself. So as within, so without means what is within my consciousness is without. If I see separate individuals as doers of their actions, that is the content of my consciousness. As within, so without. If I see everything as one, the play of consciousness, the one source consciousness within myself, if I see that, that's what I see without. Then I see everyone in my life as the play of one. You see, because this manifest world as we know it is the world of form, which appears to be outside me. It is an appearance. It appears to be outside me, but the joke, the cosmic joke is, I can only see it because I'm conscious. Now, if I can only see it because I'm conscious, does it not mean that the manifest world is within my consciousness? As within, so without. For example, if I am condemning someone, it appears that I am condemning someone outside me, without, a person without. But when I realize that that condemnation is going on in my own mind about the other, isn't that within? So if my data within is condemnation, as within, so without. It is all one. It is so important to understand this, that everything is, after all, transpiring within my own consciousness. So all the labels, all the qualities I am accusing others of are within my consciousness. Does that make sense?
Indeed, yeah. Thank you very much for that.
All right. Thank you. So we'll take one last question. Yes, Gerald.
Hi, Gautam. This last comment made me think the opposite works the same way, doesn't it?
It does.
So without, as within.
Perhaps. You could say that.
Because what's out there is what's in here.
Yes.
So that's it. It just dawned on me as I was listening to you.
You see, Gerald, I gave this short clip on the Kumbh Mela, which is a very big spiritual festival in India, where what is important in the Kumbh Mela is the dips in the water based on the constellations and the alignment of the moon. Certain days are chosen within a 45-day window for taking what is called snans. Now, these are not randomly chosen. You see, again, this is an ancient science where the energies of the cosmos, because water is most receptive to energies, it imbibes them. So the sadhus, the yogis of the Himalayas would come down from the Himalayas to dip in the waters at these specific times. Now, why? Because the human body is itself 70% water. And when the human body places itself in the body of water, in that location, in that space, at that time where the energies are suffusing the waters, as within, so without. Water within, water without. So to take maximum benefit of the energies, that is why these yogis came down from the Himalayas and took part in these baths. It is all truly one. You see, it's so simple that if I tell anyone, close your eyes and can you distinguish what is inside you from what is outside? Nobody can. There's no physical barrier between the within and without when you close your eyes. So this is the illusion, the Maya, the sense of separation, that what is outside me is separate from me. That is the illusion which is being pointed at. It is like going and standing in front of a mirror and thinking the reflection has got nothing to do with me. Isn't that absurd? To think when I stand before a mirror that what is without has nothing to do with me. And then as you say, if I see the without and know that this is me, it works the same way. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely the same.
Well, thank you very much. I've had to miss the last couple of Zoom meetings, so I'm glad to see you again. Thank you very much.
You too. Thank you. So let's just sit together for a minute or so in silence, and then we can end this meeting.